I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Our guest, David Bowes, believes that libertarianism is building support in the United States. He says, look at the growing support for marriage equality, for marijuana legalization, for criminal justice reform, and the growing concern over government surveillance and wars without end, all issues that concern libertarians. Even the candidacy of Rand Paul has shed some light on libertarian ideas, in spite of the fact that he's running for president as a Republican. Well, we wanted to know more about what libertarianism is and what it isn't, which is why we invited David Bowes to join us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. He is the executive vice president of the Cato Institute, editor of the Libertarian Reader, and his new book is called The Libertarian Mind, A Manifesto for Freedom, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And David Bowes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Your book is updated, revised from 1997 when it was first published. Does this reflect changes in libertarianism in itself over the last two decades?
Well, not so much changes in the core ideas and the chapters that are about the market process, law, civil society, pluralism, and toleration. They didn't change very much. But there are a lot of issues that have come up since 1997. You had, obviously, 9/11. You had the rise of the Internet, which was just beginning in 97 and I don't think was mentioned before. You had the financial crisis, the collapse, and the bailouts that succeeded it. Now you have the revelations about government surveillance. Marriage equality, I think I mentioned before, but it's obviously become a much bigger issue. So not a change in core ideas, but definitely a change in the kinds of issues that libertarians are talking about. And because I think more Americans are leaning in the direction of a lot of those libertarian positions, it means that I think it's a more significant part of the political spectrum these days.
So what does it mean to call yourself a libertarian?
Well, I think there are different definitions of that. To me, libertarianism is the idea that adult individuals have the right and the responsibility to make the important decisions about their own lives. And that includes decisions about how to earn money and how to spend your money and how to save for retirement and how to pick a school for your children and what to smoke and what to read and who to marry and what size of a soda you can drink. And all of those kinds of decisions government currently interferes with. But broadly, in American politics, we tend to divide everybody into liberals and conservatives, although we're kind of dimly aware that there are people who might be called fiscally conservative and socially liberal. And those people, I think, are, broadly speaking, libertarian. They're not as fully libertarian, as radically libertarian as I am, but they do differ from the liberal Democrats and the conservative Republicans because they tend to believe in more freedom in both personal and economic areas.
What do you make of the candidacy of Rand Paul, obviously running for president not as a libertarian but as a Republican? His father was a more sort of outspoken proponent of some of these libertarian ideas. I also understand that Rand Paul is going to be giving a speech today about the flat tax. I know that's something that libertarians support. How do you see then Rand Paul?
Well, he's never said he's a libertarian. He has said he is libertarian-ish, which puts him ahead of most political candidates. I do think that his father was and is more of an ideologue. Rand Paul has been much more of a senator who tried to make a difference within the Senate and is now running, I think, a front-running campaign for president, whereas his father was more of a gadfly candidate. There are issues libertarians disagree with Rand Paul on. Some libertarians would disagree with him on his being pro-life, some on his being opposed to gay marriage. But if you look at a broad range of issues, from taxes and spending and overregulation to being skeptical about foreign intervention and more wars in the Middle East, and his opposition to surveillance and his questions about criminal justice reform and its racial impact, I think that is a more libertarian program than we've seen from any major presidential candidate in my memory.
I'm curious, too, about the fact that libertarianism seems to be associated with wealthy white men, Koch brothers, I think, being a good example of that. Is that a wrong way to think about libertarianism, and does that hurt the cause?
Well, I think it probably does hurt the cause if that's what people think. I think it is a wrong perspective. And in the book, I talk about the roots of libertarianism, and I say that a lot of times people think that libertarianism is basically a philosophy of economic freedom, free markets, but it really originated in the fight for religious toleration. I think the fundamental ideas of individual rights and freedom of conscience come out of the struggles in Western civilization over religious toleration. And then it was fights over things like Magna Carta and the Glorious Revolution and the Bill of Rights and the American Revolution and abolitionism. Libertarians or classical liberals, which is what they would have been called then, were on board for civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, long before liberals and conservatives were. I have just written an op-ed in which I mentioned that the Libertarian Party was endorsing gay rights in its first platform in 1972 when the Democratic vice presidential candidate was still giving speeches calling people queers. So people should not see libertarianism as a philosophy just about economics or just about white men. Libertarians and classical liberals have been defending the rights of everybody for a long time. But I think it's good that Rand Paul has been talking so much about criminal justice reform and government surveillance and privacy, because those are very important issues.
Should we look at the Constitution, even the Declaration of Independence, and see it as libertarian documents?
Well, I guess like Rand Paul, they're libertarian-ish, but Yeah, I think all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's a pretty good statement of libertarianism. And the Constitution clearly set up a government that was designed to be as minimal as possible. In Article 1, Section 8, they laid out what the powers of the federal government were, and they were very limited because the purpose of the Constitution was to implement the philosophy that was declared in the Declaration of Independence. Now, there were obviously exceptions, and race and gender are the big ones there. Samuel Johnson, the great British writer, said, "Why is it that we hear the greatest yelps for liberty from the drivers of slaves?" Mm. Well, that was a good question. And a lot of Americans understood it was a good question, even some of those slaveholders. And it unfortunately took another 70 years before we got that problem more or less solved. But it was people with libertarian ideas like Thomas Paine and William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass who led the fight for abolitionism.
I wonder, though, whether we have seen the growth of government because it was responding to abuses by the capitalist system or by business, by corporations, thinking of things like child labor laws, also, you know, the terrible factory conditions that we had in this country, say, like 100 years ago, the working hours, the poor wages, that the government and, frankly, unions had to step in and put a stop to that.
Well, that certainly is a common perspective. It's what you would hear in public school, and there are historians who say that. I would look at it differently. I would suggest that 100 years ago, much less 200 years ago, the world was much poorer than it is today. So the alternative when there was child labor in England and the United States, or indeed in India today, is not the question of whether children should watch Captain Kangaroo and then have Miss Wilson teach them about the ABCs or work in a factory. The choice was working in a factory or dying. Life expectancy was very low back then. Deaths in childbirth were much higher than they are. Deaths of children were high. The fact is, it was a very poor society, and there wasn't much alternative to child labor. What we did see during the entire 19th century was a great rise in the standard of living, and around the end of the 19th century, people started to deplore child labor. Remember, children always worked on the farm, but that wasn't very visible to social reformers. Once there were people in the cities and in factories, child labor became more visible, and it became more visible at a time that the country was growing wealthier. So I would suggest that the government abolished child labor about the time the market and the families were already abolishing it. If they had tried to abolish child labor in 1850, there would have been a lot of misery in society. And if you tried to abolish child labor in India today, children would not end up in comfortable schools. They would end up on the street. So we have to understand that you have to build up a society's wealth before you can live at that standard of living. But yes, it's certainly true historically that there were people who saw this differently from the way I do and did want government to step in, although in many cases to solve a problem that was on the verge of being solved anyway.
Is it one way to build up wealth, to pay people more, to pay people a living wage?
Yes, and that's why wages rose throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, and the price of goods plummeted. You know, we hear about the era of the robber barons, but do you know what was happening to the price of all sorts of commodities in the late 19th century? Falling significantly. So, yes, a market economy is how you get a higher standard of living, and a higher standard of living obviously means higher wages for people. Right now, we're fighting over whether we should continue to push forward on the issue of free trade. And every economist has known since at least 1776, when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, that free trade leads to more prosperity among all the countries that are participating in it. It does mean that there will be some jobs eliminated and other jobs created, but the real point of free trade is to increase people's standard of living by making it possible to transform the resources available to us into useful things that satisfy human needs at a lower cost, and therefore being able to transform them into more satisfaction of more human needs. And I think that the principles of free trade also apply to the domestic economy. What we want is for the market process to be working so that we get we make better use of the resources available to us and we increase the resources that are available. That's why economics is a positive sum game.
And we're almost up in a break here. Sounds like you agree with the president then when it comes to the Pacific Trade Partnership that's being negotiated.
People rarely start interviews with me by saying it sounds like you agree with the president. But yes, on this particular issue, I do. He is right to say that we should increase trade with Pacific nations and with other nations. And I'm disappointed that Congress hasn't seen it that way yet.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We asked David Bowes to join us in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. It's the time we set aside to talk about election and politics related issues. He's the executive vice president of the Cato Institute, editor of the Libertarian Reader. His new book is The Libertarian Mind, and we are talking about what libertarianism is, what it isn't, where it came from, and we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with David Bowes. We are talking about libertarianism. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I see some emails here, radiotimes@whyy.org. David, email from Neil. He says, please ask your guests what libertarians think about how huge campaign spending by corporations and billionaires affects self-rule by ordinary Americans. Can you speak to that?
Sure. First, there really isn't huge campaign spending by corporations because corporate contributions to candidates have been outlawed for about a century. There are now, of course, some independent expenditures that corporations can do, but you don't see much of that from big corporations. You clearly do see it from wealthy people. One of the things it means is that more candidates can run for office because one of the things that's going to keep a lot of the Republicans in the race right now is that a lot of them do have wealthy donors who are supporting them. I think that supporting the candidate that you want to with whatever tools you have at your disposal, whether that's a newspaper editorial page or a popular website or simply money, is part of free speech. So I think the Supreme Court is correct to say that the First Amendment protects campaign spending, and I think they will continue to understand the First Amendment that way. I would say the reason people spend so much money to influence government, either to get people elected or to influence what they do when they're there, is because the government has so much power to so much money and power to hand out. If we had a government actually living under the rules in the Constitution, which is to say not being involved in spending $4 trillion a year, then people would be much less interested in getting control of it. So my argument is we need to make government much smaller and less powerful, and then you will see much less money spent on politics.
Let me ask you about the 2008 meltdown on Wall Street. Should the government have stepped in and bailed out those banks?
Well, first, the government should not have manipulated the money supply to pour cheap money into the housing market for about 8 years, causing a boom and then a bust. Manipulation of money by the Federal Reserve, it was the main cause of the housing bubble that was followed by the housing crash. But once it did happen, no, the government should not have stepped in. We should not bail out big banks. We should not send the signal to major corporations that if you're a big corporation, no matter how bad the decisions you make, we will bail you out. That's a very bad incentive system to set up. And you'll notice it doesn't really apply to small businesses. If you start a little shoe store, a restaurant, a little radio station, and you can't make a profit and go out of business, the government will not bail you out. It's only if you're a really big business. And I think corporate welfare is one of the reasons we have more inequality in the country than we need to, because we protect the big, powerful businesses and not small businesses. Not that I think we should protect them either.
Well, and I've heard it described as capitalism on the way up and socialism on the way down.
Well, there's certainly something to that. The government has declared, we don't know how many, but we know that they have internal documents in which they've declared a certain number of banks as too big to fail. And that is just an invitation. That's a softball saying, go ahead and seek to make all the profit you can with high-risk investments. If they fail, we will ensure that your enterprise does not actually go out of business.
Let me pick up on something you said, and then we'll get to our callers, and I see some more comments coming in as well. How, then, can libertarianism address this issue of income inequality, the fact that we have so many more rich people, really rich people in this country? You've got a middle class that's really, you know, hanging on by a thread in many instances. What can libertarianism do about that?
Well, I do think that libertarianism would eliminate a lot of the regulations and subsidies that protect the established players in the market. We should not have Wall Street bailouts. We should not have Chrysler bailouts. We should not have tariff protection for big businesses that makes it hard for new competitors to compete. We shouldn't have protections for the taxi cartel that are wielded against new competitors like Uber. We should want a dynamic, growing economy where you have to serve consumers every day. You don't get protected. Farm subsidies protect people who are wealthier than average. Wall Street bailouts protect people who are much wealthier than average. So all of those kinds of things I think we should get rid of, and that would be one of the ways of easing inequality. On the other hand, I just reject the idea that the middle class is barely hanging on. The average American is richer now than 10 years ago, much richer than 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The average new home is bigger than it was when I was young. Telephones are much better. We have computers. We have better cars than we did. And these things are widely owned. These are not the province of the rich. 20 years ago, I remember a rich businessman showing up at a Cato Institute event with a phone that you could carry with you. It was the size of a brick. It cost thousands of dollars. It didn't look like something you would want unless you were really like a doctor on call or you were making billion-dollar business decisions. But today, everybody's got a phone in their pocket. And that phone includes all the knowledge in the history of the world. Maybe not all the wisdom, but all the knowledge is available to you right on your phone. That is not the sign of a middle class that's just barely hanging on.
Well, I mean, that is evolution. We have cars now. We don't have horses and buggies.
But that's economic progress. That's what
I would agree with you.
To be richer.
I would totally agree with you. But when you look at the median household income in this country, it's something like, you know, $50,000 to $60,000. Let's say it's a family of four. They want to send their child to college. They want to save for retirement, maybe take a vacation now and then. That is not a lot of money for a middle class middle class household, especially when we so much depend on people spending money in this country to keep the economy afloat.
Well, but it's more money than middle class households had when I was starting out 30 years ago, and it's a lot more than when my parents were starting out 60 years ago. So it is economic growth. We have more things we'd like to buy. You know, my parents didn't really think about taking vacations. We went to my grandmother's house for a vacation. Middle class people do take vacations now. Standard of living is clearly up. Now, over the past 5 years, we had a severe recession,
indeed,
and it isn't necessarily up during that period. One of the things that is confusing about that median income standard is that a lot more income is received as fringe benefits today, healthcare benefits, retirement benefits at work, those kinds of things. So if you take real total compensation, it's up more than that. I would say, when you talk about the cost of college, government subsidies have dramatically increased the price of college. We think, oh, we'll give more student aid and more students will be able to go to college. And this year, that's true. But the subsidies then allow colleges to raise their list prices. And the list price of college has gone way up compared to inflation. Now, is that because a college education is actually twice as good as it was when I went to college? I don't think so. It may be somewhat more gold-plated. When I went to college, one of the questions my parents and I faced was, would I pay them to install a telephone in my dorm room? Well, that's not a question any middle-class kid asks today. You don't need a phone in your dorm room because you're going to have one in your pocket.
That's David Bowes, our guest in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We are talking about libertarianism. He's a libertarian, executive vice president of the Cato Institute. The Libertarian Mind, a book that he wrote almost 20 years ago, has been updated and revised. And joining us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times to talk about what it means to be a libertarian. And it looks like we have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me get Ben from Manayunk to join us. Ben, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. I just wanted to sort of elaborate on a little bit of a point that he mentioned earlier about the child labors and the standards through other countries that we would be having as far as the trade. As far as what he was mentioning as far as unfettered trade and capitalism without regulation will raise all ships, if you don't have that standard in the other countries that were trading with, as far as saying, well, at least they have a job instead of being dead and sick and poor. You know, that's not really good enough to see the world as it is instead of trying to make the world what it should be. You know, right now the average CEO pay is probably 200 times more than the average worker. And it seems like sort of a way without that regulation, as far as which some sort of gets framed as a bad word nowadays, protection for the workers, it seems like a way just to funnel money towards the CEOs and not having any help out for the rest of the workers in the world.
Well, Ben, let me take your comment and give David a chance to respond to that. And he talks about unfettered trade. I think this sort of gets us back to the trade agreement that's currently being debated in Washington. And it is interesting to look at a country like the United States. There are other developed countries part of this trade agreement as well. But when you're dealing with countries that pay people, you know, a dollar a day, how do you make it an even, Steven deal for the United States?
It's not even Steven. It's not supposed to be even Steven. It's comparative advantage. We all benefit on both sides of that trade if everybody does what they have a comparative advantage at. In the United States, making cheap textiles is not our comparative advantage. Making movies, making insurance, making software products, making complicated machinery, making radio programs, all of those kinds of things are comparative advantages of the United States. Making cheap textiles is something that China is better at than we are. And the best way for us to get cheap clothes is to trade something to people in China for them. It's good for China and it's good for us. If you try to impose a $7.25 minimum wage on China or Mexico, you would create mass unemployment. Everyone in Mexico would lose their job. That is not good for Mexico. It's not good for the United States. What we do know, look, I live in Virginia. And I buy stuff all the time that's made in Pennsylvania. Do I care how it's being made in Pennsylvania? Do I care whether Virginia is getting jobs to make that thing? No. Nobody worries about free trade within the United States. Why should we worry about trade across national lines? And that's economically, they're artificial borders. Free trade makes both countries more prosperous.
Well, it seems to me you don't need to worry about free trade in Pennsylvania because chances are people are paid at least a minimum wage. There's some, safety requirements in factories, things like that. That is a kind of apples to apples comparison, it seems to me.
Well, to some extent, but, the minimum wage and the average wage in Mississippi are a lot less than they are in Pennsylvania. Does that mean Pennsylvania should refuse to accept imports from Mississippi? No.
Probably not, no. But I think you understand if we want to lift all boats, the question is, how do you do that?
If you want to lift the boats of people in the third world or whatever we call it now, the developing world, the poorest people in the world. If that's what you're concerned about, then what will help them is being able to sell things to the United States, which they can make cheaper than we can. If we try to impose our regulatory standards and our minimum wage laws on people whose skills aren't very developed, whose infrastructure isn't as good, then they will not have jobs. And we might end up making everything here in the United States, but we would make less of it because 300 million people can't make as much stuff as 7 billion people can make. So if you want to benefit the poorest people in the world, trade with them. Buy the stuff they produce. And what happens when you do that is that the country starts to build up an economic infrastructure and international companies come in and they start to bid up the prices. You talk about a Nike factory pays people a dollar a day. Why do people go to work in it? Because everybody else in the country is paying 50 cents a day. So Nike is making that person better off at a dollar a day. And when that happens, and when they get skills, and when factories develop, then other people come in and offer $1.25, $1.50, $2 a day. There are countries that were making cheap textiles 10 or 20 years ago, and now they're not because their countries have become more advanced and labor is too expensive, and the countries have moved on to places where the labor is cheaper. And in the countries that traded with us first, they're now making more profitable products. Trade is lifting all boats in this country and in other countries. And the reason we have slow economic growth in the United States is because we do have too big a burden of regulation. We've added Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank and all the regulations of Obamacare and all the unlegislated regulations from the EPA, not your basic clean air requirements, but lots of detailed regulations, lots of labor regulations. You may have seen yesterday in California, a court ruled that Uber drivers are employees, not independent contractors. And if that's the case, Uber becomes vastly unprofitable. So all of these regulations are slowing down growth, and that's why we have slow growth and less of a standard of living than we should have in the United States.
And only a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, I want to put a couple of other things on the table. Is there a libertarian candidate running for president? I know there has been in the past. Has someone declared?
I don't actually know. The Libertarian Party, I'm sure, will be running a presidential candidate. It may well be Gary Johnson, who ran 2 years ago, although I don't know that that's true, but yes, I assume they will have a candidate.
And we are all waiting, I think, with bated breath while this, the Supreme Court issues its ruling on whether states have to recognize same-sex marriage, states that have I made a little mistake here. I need to just quickly reintroduce you, David Boas. Boas, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Sorry about that. I missed something in my little clock here. I've only been doing this for 28 years. What do you hope the Supreme Court decides as it relates to gay marriage?
Well, I hope the Supreme Court decides that marriage equality is, in fact, required by the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. The Cato Institute has filed numerous amicus briefs advocating gay rights from the Lawrence case back in 2003 to the case right now before the Supreme Court, advocating that the court find equal rights for gay people. And so I hope they do that. If they don't, I think public opinion has changed enough that we're going to see more and more states adopting marriage equality on their own.
And what do you hope they decide about the Affordable Care Act?
I hope they will decide that the words of the statute mean what they say, and the government must obey the words that are written in the law. And the words in the law say that certain kinds of exchanges are eligible for subsidies and others are not. And the fact that the president thought it was a good idea to give everybody subsidies is not permitted. Ever since Magna Carta, there are limits on what the president, the monarch, the sovereign, can do on his own. So I hope the court will find that the government has to obey the law.
The law meaning these four words that are in this gigantic
every word
piece of legislation.
In a law, every word in a law is the law.
I use the word monarch. Do you think of President Obama as a monarch?
I think both President Bush and President Obama have assumed to themselves powers that monarchs could only dream of. President Bush said that he had the authority on his own say-so, without any review by a court or by Congress, to arrest American citizens and hold them without access to a lawyer or a judge. President Obama said, "You think that's a lot? I have the authority on my own say-so to assassinate American citizens." So, yes, I think those are monarchical powers, and I wish the Congress and the courts would rein them in.
David Boas, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And he's the executive vice president of the Cato Institute, author of The Libertarian Mind. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We've got a second guest waiting in the wings. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Earlier this week in Miami, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush announced that he was indeed running for president.
So here's what it comes down to. Our country's on a very bad course. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? The question for me is, what am I going to do about it? And I've decided I'm a candidate for president of the United States of America.
He is the third Bush to make a bid for the White House, and he joins a growing field of Republican candidates. We asked David Ketanese to join us. He's senior politics writer for U.S. News and World Report, founder of the blog called The Run 2016. And David Ketanese, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Was Bush kind of forced into making this announcement? I remember the interview that he did with Bob Schieffer telling him that he wanted to run for president but hadn't decided, and Bob Schieffer wasn't really buying that argument.
Well, look, I mean, he did this pre-presidential stage for about 6 months. It was getting to be the point where he couldn't really wait any longer in order to really begin organizing in the state, paying field staff, particularly for his presidential campaign. But with the campaign laws the way they are now, he basically operated a pre-presidential campaign through a leadership PAC. But, you know, this is getting to be crunch time. You had 10, 11 candidates in. So I think, you know, this was the time that he needed to get in. But he did it on his own terms. I mean, a lot of people went earlier than Jeb Bush did. And just because of our campaign finance laws, that allowed him to raise a lot more money and bank it earlier.
And how much money has he been able to raise? Do you know that?
Well, it's uncertain. There have been some public reports out there that he was going to raise $100 million within the first 6 months. Then some of his aides came back and tamped that down and said, no, that's not true. They've never put a number on it. Most candidates don't. They don't want to reveal their hand before the reports come out. But we will know later this summer in July when they have to file their first reports with the Federal Election Commission. That's when we'll know what all these guys and gals have raised.
Well, his campaign sign is the word Jeb with an exclamation point. And as many have remarked, there's no Jeb Bush there with an exclamation point. How's he going to deal with his last name?
Well, look, he's trying to deal with it head on. He says in a lot of his speeches that I've seen him give, look, I'm my own man. I'm not my father. I'm not my brother. I love them both, but you know, and I love my family, but I'm a different Bush. But frankly, at this point in the race, I think it has been a burden for him. You know, on the plus side, it does get him access to all the donors that and all of the contributors that know and revere his father or his brother. But frankly, if he was a two-term governor named Jeb Johnson from Florida, he'd have an accomplished record to run on and could run as someone, you know, new and fresh. But because his last name is Bush, there's a lot of Republicans around the country that feel like we need to turn the page. And in order to defeat Hillary Clinton, they need to elect or put forth someone that's younger and fresher for a more bold contrast. So, you know, he's trying to deal with it head on, and I think he's dealing with it as best as he can. But I think it's going to be a burden throughout the Republican primary and, frankly, in a general election as well if he is the Republican nominee.
And how about his support for immigration reform, for Common Core? Do you think that will hurt him among primary Republicans?
You know, it's interesting. I think at the beginning of the cycle, everyone thought immigration was going to be the Achilles heel for Jeb Bush. But frankly, just being out in these early states and seeing what voters are talking about, primary voters, these are Republican primary voters, it seems like the Common Core education standards are really what gets people fired up. I was at a town hall in New Hampshire, and one woman has gone to every town hall she can to talk to every candidate about how much she opposes Common Core. And she's usually, it's the same woman. She's the first questioner. You see signs in people's yards to stop Common Core in some of these early primary states. I've seen them in South Carolina as well. So I think that could be the issue that he struggles with more so than even immigration. Because if you remember, even though a lot of conservatives are opposed to comprehensive immigration reform, you know, Mitt Romney, John McCain had signaled similar support for comprehensive approaches in the past, and they became the Republican nominee. So I don't think it's a disqualifier for Jeb, but certainly it's something he's going to have to deal with. But frankly, he hasn't moved on those issues. The one thing you've got to say about him is he hasn't wavered so far. He's basically said to the Republican audience, this is where I stand. I understand a lot of you disagree with me, but I'm going to stand on principle. And I think he'll use that to contrast with some other Republicans who have moved around on these issues of Common Core and immigration as his campaign gets ramped up.
It's interesting. He's the third Republican candidate who speaks fluent Spanish. What do you make of that?
Right. Well, I think it's helpful. I mean, if you looked at the composition just of the people at his rally on Monday, it was the most diverse, you know, rally you've seen, maybe even more diverse than Hillary Clinton's in New York on Saturday. I mean, it was, you know, maybe as much as half Hispanic in the audience. And, you know, Bush spoke to that. He spoke, you know, at two lines at the end of his speech. He delivered in Spanish. He's doing Spanish media. So this is going to be part of his appeal. I mean, his wife he met, she's a Hispanic woman. So, you know, he talks about that on the trail. So this is a big part of his life. This is a way to distinguish himself from, frankly, his father and his brother. So I think it'll be a big part of his campaign because Republicans know they need to do better with Hispanics. Jeb Bush isn't going to win the Hispanic vote. He's not going to get a majority of it. But if he can get a third or more than a third, that would go a long way for him to being able to win the presidency.
David, tell us where you are now.
I am at the Road to Majority Conference. It's sponsored by the Faith and Freedom Coalition in Washington, D.C., where over the next 2 days, you'll have most of the Republican presidential candidates speaking before a social conservative audience. This is an annual gathering, but obviously this year it's sort of heightened expectations because you're going to have about 10 to 12 candidates come through here and make their pitches to social conservatives. Today, Marco Rubio is here, a senator from Florida. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky and Senator Ted Cruz from Texas will be addressing the conference.
And that's David Catanese, senior politics writer for U.S. News and World Report, founder of the blog called The Run 2016, joining us in this portion of Radio Times to talk about two new Republican candidates this week. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. The email address is radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, the other Republican candidate Donald Trump also announced the start of his presidential campaign at Trump Tower in New York City this week with his signature glitz and bombast.
I would do various things very quickly. I would repeal and replace the big lie Obamacare. I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. And I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words. Yeah. Nobody would be tougher on ISIS than Donald Trump. Woo. Nobody.
And again, David Catanese joining us. And I have to say, David, we were listening or going through Donald Trump's announcement yesterday. We couldn't decide which was the most outrageous of his various comments. Outrageous and, frankly, in many cases, offensive comments that he made there. I mean, just taking that 30-second little soundbite, it sounds like he's running for dictator. He would tell Mexico to pay for this very cheap wall that he could build.
You know, is there anyone it's funny to watch the contrast between or the dichotomy between Jeb Bush's announcement and Donald Trump's announcement. I mean, there's probably no two candidates that are as different as far as temperament, tone and style than Jeb Bush and Donald Trump. Look, listen, on Donald Trump, this is sort of a circus. He's a performance artist, I think, is what you would call him. I mean, he's endlessly entertaining. I have to confess, I couldn't stop watching the interviews he's been giving over the past couple of days because he's outrageous and will sort of say anything. So you don't know what he'll say. I mean, who says at a presidential announcement, I'm really rich? I mean, everyone else usually focuses on their humble beginnings, how they pulled themselves up from their bootstraps, the struggles they went through. I mean, this guy stood up there and said, I'm really rich. I'm going to make Mexicans pay for the border, for a wall. And the people that are running our country now are losers. So, I mean, he threw out his entire script. His campaign put out a scripted speech, which he completely ignored. He basically went on a 45-minute rant. And, you know, people can laugh at him, and, you know, a lot of us are, but frankly, if he qualifies for the Republican debates, he could be a real problem if he's throwing bombast at these other candidates like Jeb Bush.
Well, and one wonders, too, because he has made noises about running for president, I think, since 2000. He still, as I understand it, has to file forms with the FEC within something like 14 or 15 days. So
right.
I think there's some question about whether he is technically and actually running for president.
I think you hear a lot of that from reporters. Is he just punking us again? Is he just leading us on again? Is this for real? I mean, he did say, I'm running for president. You know, you take the guy for his word, but I think there will be a lot of reporters checking the FEC, whether he has made that filing within 2 weeks from now, because, you know, there's no telling what his real motivations are with all of this.
Do you think the Republican Party would like to distance itself from this candidate?
Yeah, I think if you talk to the Republican National Committee, they wouldn't say it publicly, but privately they would say we'd rather him go away. We don't want him on our debate stage. I mean, you could have a real scenario where you have elected officials, people that have led states or been in the Senate for two or three terms, not included in the first Republican primary debate, which will be highly watched and highly covered because of Donald Trump. But you can't ignore Donald Trump because he's a celebrity, right? Mm-hmm. And so he has an audience. And so every time he gets in front of a microphone, the media is going to cover it. Now, I think eventually it's going to be the media is going to have to confront their own moment of how much do we cover him? How seriously do we take him? But in some ways, he's irresistible to cover because it's always entertaining. So that this is going to be an X factor that is sort of unprecedented before, given his stature and his money. I mean, this is a guy worth $8 billion. What if he decides just to start putting millions of dollars in ads attacking, a certain Republican because he doesn't like Jeb Bush? That could have a big impact on the race. He's not going to be the nominee, but he could destroy someone who could be the nominee.
Is there a risk of feeding his narcissism?
I think absolutely. I mean, and this is where sort of the media component, comes in as how much, how many columns do we devote to him? How much time do we give to him? I think this week, he's announced he's going to get his media blitz, just like all the candidates do. But, if he just, continues to say outrageous things and, that sort of don't regard any facts and just, hurls insults at people, does he merit coverage for the long haul, the presidential race? Because we know he's not going to stop talking.
And you're listening, we're talking on Radio Times to David Catanese, and we are talking about, I couldn't remember his name, Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, two new Republicans who announced this week that they want to be president of the United States. And you're listening to Ballot Talks here on Radio Times on WHYY. David, you had a piece this morning about how Joe Biden still might be considering a run for the White House. Of course, his son died recently, a very, very sad and tragic death of a very promising young man. And I know that Joe Biden was very much at his bedside over the last couple of months. Is he seriously considering a run, from what you understand?
From the two sources that I spoke to who have spoken to members of the family within the past week, they told me that he is. And we do have the full story on U.S. News right now. I think the conventional wisdom has been that Joe Biden was not going to run for president just because of Hillary Clinton and the power that she presents as a front runner. You look at polling, she leads him by, 40 to 50 points in these early states. It looks like a pretty daunting task. Then he had this terrible tragedy happen in his life with his son, and that definitely has, put any immediate political decisions on hold. But, these two sources did tell me that they have, if members of the family have said he has not ruled it out yet, and he knows he has to make a decision soon and has set that timetable for sometime before August 1st. So that's about a month and a half now that he's going to have to make a decision. Look, the conventional wisdom is that he probably wouldn't run. But remember, this cycle, most people that we thought weren't going to run, I mean, people were skeptical about Trump. They weren't sure if Mike Huckabee was going to do it. People didn't think Martin O'Malley would run against Hillary Clinton. And everyone has pulled the trigger. The only person that really hasn't is Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee last time. He pulled his name out early. But sort of the operating procedure has been everybody's running for this open seat. So it seems to me that he's still thinking about it and thinking about it seriously.
And we're almost out of time here. And so many people running, both largely Republican, but some Democrats as well, because it is an open seat, David?
Yes, I think the open seat, I mean, if you remember last time in 2012, a lot of people did not run because they did not think they could beat a Democratic incumbent. It's always harder to beat an incumbent than win an open seat. I think that's why, especially, you see some of your Republicans running.
On that note, thank you so much for joining us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, David. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, David Catanese, senior politics writer for U.S. News and World Report, founder of the blog The Run 2016. And we began our conversation with David Bowes, executive vice president of the Cato Institute, talking about libertarianism. Looks like you got our listeners very fired up. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.